From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
This all started with an FBI investigation into emails between Petraeus and his biographer.
Petraeus and Broadwell had exchanged numerous messages, some of them coded, others explicit.
American forces in Afghanistan, General John Allen, he's implicated as well. Apparently 20 to 30,000 pages of emails with Jill Kelly, who set the FBI on Paula Broadwell.
The name of that mystery agent who first exposed the Petraeus affair. He is Frederick Humphreys, notorious for sending shirtless photos of himself to another key player in the scandal.
And what a long, strange week it's been for David Petraeus and anyone who consumes the news. What started out as his exposed affair with his biographer soon enveloped another general, another woman, and an FBI agent. Every news cycle offered a new twist. Shirtless photos, vague threats, burner email accounts. This scandal had everything, including a few journalistic mea culpas from writers at places like the New York Times and Wired, admissions that they too had fallen prey to the appeal of Petraeus. They say he seduced them into uncritical coverage by being precisely what no one expects a military or government official to be: thoughtful, intellectual, candid, and accessible. Investigative International reporter John Anderson says Petraeus became a lighthouse in the fog for war reporters.
I think those reporters who were on the ground risking their lives and trying to see some light through the chaos in places like Iraq and Afghanistan found in Petraeus someone who seemed to be a kind of virtuous warrior. He was attributed almost mythic qualities that he could never truly live up to, and which, of course, weren't the whole story of those wars. We began to feel good about ourselves again.
He was very savvy and charming in a way that a lot of top military commanders aren't. There was no Pentagon speak. There were no clipped, disingenuous statements. He spent time getting to know the reporters who covered him. Is that necessarily manipulative?
No, I'm not suggesting he personally was. I put the onus of responsibility more on the kind of collective urge to find a hero by Americans, in which reporters were amongst them. In many cases, with the best of intentions, they found a charming man. Charm is a nice attribute, but it's not a virtue. It doesn't mean that you are necessarily a heroic figure because you're charming and because your predecessors were rude.
The General Petraeus that won Washington over was certainly very convenient for the George W. Bush administration. After the debacle of Iraq, he personified a sense of command and success.
Whereas before, our gaze had been fixated upon the kind of behavior of people like George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, with their kind of arrogant attitudes and unremittingly bellicose posturing. While on the ground in these wars, what we were seeing was an unraveling. And so to finally have a commander come along who spoke bluntly and honestly, if only in private, to some reporters about a degree of American error in the war must have been refreshing to those reporters. Yes, to a certain degree, David Petraeus was a concoction of both White House media manipulation and a kind of willingness on the part of journalists to have a guy like this.
Your piece looked at how the press at large handled Petraeus, but you express no personal culpability in your reporting. To what degree were you yourself guilty of falling under the spell of this charismatic commander?
This may sound self-serving, but I don't include myself in it. I didn't report with him. I had been in Iraq before the war, and I went through the American shock and awe invasion staying in Baghdad rather than being embedded with troops. And I, to the longest extent possible, I continued to try to report Iraq from the Iraqi perspective, which I felt was sorely lacking and useful. So having been through all of that, I wasn't likely to swoon at the first sight of a kind of general that talked nice.
But wasn't his very competence and openness in the face of opacity and a string of strategic blunders the very qualities that made him so appealing to the press who had seen exactly the same errors that you had?
I think that at some level, most Americans who were in Iraq were aware that this was a sinking ship. And the fact that he emerged, and he somehow seemed to be a kind of, you know, straight shooter, a Boy Scout type, many people warmed him for that reason. My point is not that they were wrong necessarily to do so. I'm merely pointing out the syndrome. And we mostly thought of him when we thought of Iraq, rather than Blackwater, Fallujah, Abu Ghraib, and all the rest of the sad and tawdry things that we somehow brought about in that country.
You know, we continue to talk about Petraeus in the past tense here. He's not dead. He is not accused of a crime, but clearly he has been shown to be a god with feet of clay. The question is, could he have gotten there without the press deifying him to begin with?
I do think that this is probably not a bad thing for David Petraeus. You know, he may well be a man of heroic proportions. If he is, when all of the smoke clears, we will know that. Because what was not truly him, what was concocted, whether by the press or by the White House or whoever, will have disappeared. We will see a man who has great qualities and feet of clay. And that's probably a better sort of hero to have in our day and age.
John Lee, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Lee Anderson wrote The Petraeus Illusion for The New Yorker.
Among the many issues raised by the Petraeus affair is privacy. As best we can tell, the FBI accessed electronic communications from the main players, Petraeus, Broadwell, General John Allen, and Floridian friend of generals, Jill Kelly. We don't know exactly what the FBI did or what sort of legal barriers they had to surmount to get access. Reporter Peter Moss wrote on the ProPublica and New Yorker websites that an unexpected consequence of Petraeus's fall is that we all might learn a little more about how the FBI operates, and maybe, just maybe, see a few more protections put in place. To make his case, Moss points to the fallout from the invasion of privacy endured by Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork in 1987.
And one of the things that happened during his nomination battle is that an enterprising reporter for a Washington City paper went to Bork's local video rental place and went to the assistant manager and said, I'm working on a story about Robert Bork. Really interested to see what videos he's rented out from you.
The assistant manager said, sure, I'll go look. And apparently he'd rented 146 movies and they are wholesome features, and there's a lot of Meryl Streep and Bette Midler.
And as the reporter Michael Dolan wrote in his story, despite what all you pervs were hoping, there's not an X in the bunch and hardly an R.
Nevertheless, even though it was an empty vault for news, it did lead to the swift passage of the Video Privacy Protection Act in 1988.
Within months, the bill to basically protect against this kind of thing happening to any American was being debated, and then it was approved, which basically made it illegal for companies to give away lists of sales or rentals of videos to any person, any business, without the express consent of their customer.
Except for law enforcement, and only then with an appropriate warrant.
Exactly.
Do we really need to speculate as to why this law was passed so quickly?
We don't need to speculate because we pretty much know. Because this is a case where one of the political elite in Washington was really kind of blasted by a privacy violation. And the political elite in Washington were really afraid of this. And they didn't want this to happen to them.
So what's all this got to do with the electronic communications between Petraeus and Broadwell and Liz Kelly and General Allen?
Congress has been really reluctant in the last decade to consider or pass any significant privacy protection law because there hasn't been very much of a constituency for it. The ACLU and organizations like it, as active and vociferous as they are on these issues, do not have as much sway in Washington as perhaps they'd like. So really, there hasn't been much action at all. But now you have one of Congress's own, Petraeus, not a member of Congress, of course, but he is part of the political elite. One of their own has been hit quite substantially by the lack of privacy protections.
In your piece, you talk about prior efforts of the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation to request information or file lawsuits that could determine the extent of the government's surveillance powers. What have they learned?
One of the really frustrating things, and this is very much at play in the Petraeus situation right now, is that we don't actually know what kind of information was accessed with what warrants, if any, and what sorts of legal oversight were involved. And that's why these lawsuits are filed, to get more information about what are the legal guidelines that the FBI files. These are lawsuits that are not just kind of about, you know, trying to disclose information, but whether or not it is constitutionally legal for the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to go after all this information. These are questions that did not exist 15 years ago, but these technologies did not exist. So in this void of legislation, in this void of Supreme Court verdicts, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies really have a very easy time at getting a huge amount of data if they want it.
Okay, so if the Supreme Court has yet to offer a comprehensive answer, you suggest that, as in the situation following the exposure of the Bork video list, Congress may find that it's within its interest to act swiftly.
This Petraeus saga could be the kind of eureka moment. And of course, could is an important word to emphasize here. But everybody in Congress has to realize that they could be the next Petraeus or Bork. Because the FBI has the power to rummage through anybody's email with a semi-legitimate excuse. And so if you're sitting in Congress now and you realize, because of what's happened to David Petraeus of all people, that it can happen to anybody, including you, you have a little bit more incentive to maybe do something to tighten the screws on more privacy protection in America, because you realize, like, you know, hey, what's in my inbox?
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Moss writes on digital security for ProPublica. His article on the Petraeus saga appears on the websites of ProPublica and The New Yorker.
Coming up, why one Mormon reporter who covered Mitt Romney's campaign never told the candidate about their shared faith.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the American political establishment argues about the FBI's lack of transparency when following the email trail that ultimately led to the Petraeus Broadwell tryst, Mexico still struggles even to have that sort of argument. It's been 10 eventful years since Mexico passed some of the world's most liberal sunshine laws, and the light they've since shed alternately dazzles, flickers, or fades to black.
There was a famous phrase that one always heard when one had a basic question about the way things worked in Mexico. No sabría decirle. I wouldn't know what to tell you.
Kate Doyle is a senior analyst of U.S. policy in Latin America at the National Security Archive.
So you would be the parent of a child who had reached school age and you wanted to know, what kind of schools are there? What kind of budgets do they have? And what kind of programs? Pues no sabría decirle. You're in a neighborhood that was allocated funds to build a water treatment plant. Well, that was 3 years ago and it hasn't been built yet. When is it going to come? No sabría decirle.
This summer, On the Media hit the road in Mexico to gauge the influence of new media on the elections there, to report on the murders of journalists covering the drug war, and to assess the impact of 10 years of Mexican sunshine laws. We explored the first two in an hour that aired in June. Now we finally bring you the story of Mexico's illuminating experiment in sunshine, launched 11 years ago at a history-making conference of academics, lawyers, and activists in Oaxaca. The National Security Archive's Kate Doyle was there.
This was 10 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, 10 years after a new sense of what democratic government meant internationally. Countries all over the world were beginning to pass their own freedom of information legislation.
It was a crucial moment in Mexican politics. For the first time in seven decades, a party other than the invincible PRI was in power. Now the PAN party held a tenuous grip on the presidency, but not a congressional majority. All felt vulnerable. All felt they could do with a little sunshine. Suddenly, political outsiders were in a position to do the unprecedented. Craft a law based on the presumption that almost all information generated by the government is public information. The law made it far easier to file a request and far easier to appeal than it is in the U.S. It's more comprehensive than America's FOIA law. It's much closer to Sweden's gold standard. And yet...
The World Economic Forum, they analyze public policies of transparency. They rank 142 countries, and Mexico is in the 70th place.
70 out of 142. Ernesto Villanueva, law professor at Mexico's National Autonomous University, helped write the Sunshine Law, law so radical that it required amending the Constitution. So why does Mexico's transparency record rank in the world's middle? There are so many reasons.
The problem is, in Mexico, the freedom of information law is an orphan. We don't have a family of laws that we need. Fiscalization laws, accountability laws, many other laws.
Moreover, the Federal Institute for Access to Information, or IFAI, which administers the laws, is riddled with conflicts of interest. Its commissioners are lured with promises of better jobs or threatened with audits. In fact, he says, all this transparency has only led to more cynicism about a rotten system. You can use the law, expose a politician's corruption, but then...
Nothing changes.
Nothing changes. He recounts one reporter's effort to obtain the invoices of a judge who spent pots of public money on pricey women's underwear and received millions of pesos in bribes. The official was confronted.
When they ask what happened with this, yes, I did it. Why? Now what? Nothing. The law says nothing.
It's a very frustrating situation.
Yes.
You know, you're painting an image for me. I think of opening a door and on the other side is a brick wall.
Right. I'm afraid so. Unfortunately, yes.
I am Anabel Hernandez. I'm a Mexican journalist. For 18 years.
Hernandez, an investigative journalist, ran up against that brick wall soon after the PAN party candidate, Vicente Fox, won the presidency, displacing the PRI candidate for the first time in living memory. Fox had campaigned against presidential extravagance, but...
What I found was exorbitant, surreal expenses in the household items, one of which was a set of hand towels. Each one of them was $400.
Eventually, under pressure from the president, she was fired, but she's still working. And now, with the passage of the Sunshine Laws, she has a new tool, and she uses it. Not for information, but to learn what officials are trying to hide.
When I generally ask for those files, they tell me they don't exist. But I have a copy in my hand. It's a corroboration tool for me.
So you had legal documents and you used the transparency law to show you what the government was trying to hide.
Yes, the law works, but one has to be very crafty. One needs to know how to ask the question to get the information that we need without stressing, A, how important it is for us, and B, for them to understand what is our ultimate goal. I'm going to give you an example.
Hernandez wanted to learn which drug dealers were doing legitimate business with the defense ministry. She found that a nephew of the head of the dreaded Sinaloa cartel was providing the ministry with maintenance and transportation, and she used the FOIA law to prove it in her own special way.
I applied for every possible contract for maintenance of every plane, and I got them all.
You hit it. You hit your request in a pile of non-essential requests.
Of course, yes.
So I catch them.
There's this long period in which people test the law. They send requests. They get stymied. They try to send them again. And they get information or they don't.
Kate Doyle of the National Security Archive was not only present at the creation of Mexico's Sunshine Law, but actually helped to write it.
This is a process of working the kinks out of what is really an innovative and quite extraordinary piece of legislation for Mexico. And we're in the middle of that.
And it's already led to some extraordinary revelations about, for instance, subsidies to small farmers.
They found, after years of filing requests to get the raw data on how much money was going to who, that people who were, unsurprisingly, connected to the government, people who had huge corporate farms, received the most subsidies. And that project really transformed the way agricultural subsidies were made. But groups that were inured to the neglect and condescension of the government in the face of their inquiry have yet to be, in many cases, convinced that this is a mechanism that can work for them.
Doyle is clear-eyed about the government's disinclination to comply with the Sunshine Laws. She's seen the power of EFI curtailed and its budgets held hostage by the very people who stand to lose the most if information is unleashed.
But even some members of the government and Congress are pushing back. And right now, as we speak, there are a series of reforms that the new president-elect has backed.
There is much that Mexicans don't know about the drug war, political corruption, Mexico's own dirty war. But Doyle believes, based on years working on human rights in the region, that ultimately Mexicans will embrace the idea that they deserve to know. While Mexico's Information Institute struggles to let light in, another news outlet in Mexico has dimmed. The Houston Chronicle, the largest daily newspaper in Texas, has just shuttered its Mexico City bureau. While in Mexico this past June, we attended a weekly get-together of foreign journalists at a dive cantina in Mexico City. That's where we first met the Chronicle's longtime bureau chief, Dudley Althaus, a jocular Navy veteran from Ohio who now calls Mexico his home. When we heard about his bureau closing, we gave him a call to ask him about the future of U.S. news bureaus in Mexico and, of course, those cantina nights.
I mean, we were joking the other day, we're going to know we've been in here too long when people start dropping dead at the table at the cantina. We have to establish a rule that whoever dies at the table pays, right?
Solemn going through the wallet of the deceased.
Exactly. A new tradition at the cantina.
Dudley Althaus ran the Chronicle's Mexico City Bureau for more than two decades and has been in Mexico for almost three. He's the first to point out that the Chronicle's budget woes that led to the Bureau's closing are not unique, but the relationship between the Houston Chronicle and Mexico is.
A British journalist friend of mine wrote that it would be similar to a London newspaper shutting down its Northern Ireland Bureau in the midst of the troubles of the 1980s. Very intense connections between the two countries at a very intense time for Mexico. Newspapers on the East Coast or LA are not really focused on what's happening on the Texas border. For the U.S. media to go ever darker on this very important subject is a tragedy.
Why is it so very important for readers in Houston to know what's going on in Mexico?
The population of Houston is large plurality, Mexican or Mexican-American, and the business ties between Houston and Mexico are intense. Just Houston-Mexico trade is $32 billion a year. They go to Mexico on vacation. They have friends that live in Mexico. The U.S.-Mexico relationship has always been defined by the Texas-Mexico border.
Could you sum up the last quarter century in Mexico? What have you seen?
Right after I arrived in July of 1988, the ruling party, the PRI, which took power in 1929, by many people's viewpoints, stole the election, backed up by the U.S. government. There was tremendous political violence through a lot of southern Mexico after that, which culminated in 1994 with the Zapatista, the Maya Indian Rebellion in Chiapas. And then it settled down, and, you know, Mexico was always defined by trying to discover modernity. Throughout the 1990s, under NAFTA, Mexico was on a path to become one of the world's largest economies. I think it's the 13th largest in the world.
A former New York Times Mexico City bureau chief called the closing of your bureau the end of an era. And McClatchy's Mexico City bureau chief, Tim Johnson, wrote, "Sad news to those who understand how closely the fates of the United States and Mexico are linked."
It is a bad thing, but how many papers have shut down their bureaus? Boston, Newsday, Philadelphia, Chicago, San Antonio, San Diego, Arizona Republic, at one point New Orleans, Times-Picayune. It's just gone dark. I mean, you can either go home or you stay here.
And you're not leaving?
I'm not leaving. I'm committed to this story, and I'm committed to foreign news.
What are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to freelance. You know, many correspondents from the big papers come for maybe 5 years. It was very unusual that I would be here this long.
Dudley, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Dudley Althaus has been a foreign correspondent for nearly 3 decades, and until last month was the Mexico City bureau chief for the Houston Chronicle. One of the dogs that never quite barked in the election cycle was the question of Mitt Romney's Mormonism. Early on, pundits asked if America was ready for a Mormon president, but by Election Day, other issues had overtaken the Mormon question. However, one journalist for whom Romney's religion stayed in the foreground was BuzzFeed reporter McKay Coppins. Coppins was assigned to cover Romney during the campaign, and like Romney, he is a practicing Mormon, although he never actually told anyone in the Romney family that he shared their faith. The closest he came was a moment when Romney's wife, Anne, asked the press corps if any of them could speak Spanish.
Somebody said, "McKay does. I speak because I learned it as a missionary serving in the Latino neighborhoods in Texas." And so she kind of turned to me and said, "Oh, you speak?" And in that moment, I thought, this is a great opportunity to let her know that I'm a Mormon. I've never quite figured out why, but I didn't take it. I just said, "Yes, I speak Spanish," and then just kind of let the conversation roll on. As a Mormon, there's almost this genetic longing to feel normal. And for a lot of my life, I would kind of squirm when I was asked questions about things like the racial legacy of the church, like polygamy. But I found myself in the weird situation this year of being the journalist who was often asking those questions, right? Because I knew I should, and because I knew that there was no way these things didn't influence Mitt Romney's worldview. But at the same time, I also kind of recognized his desire to avoid them because I had gone through that myself as a younger Mormon.
Theoretically, your shared faith would seem to give you a little bit more sympathy, perhaps, for the man. But the campaign mainly saw your faith as a liability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, several people actually in the campaign told me they're worried that you speak a language that the candidate speaks and that they don't, right? And so they kind of thought that every question I asked them about Romney's faith had this kind of gotcha lurking behind it. They saw it as something that made me, I guess, more dangerous.
You observed in your piece both how devout Romney was and also how aggressively the campaign tried to downplay it. And it seems like the inverse of how American politics typically works.
It's so true. I mean, think of how many presidential candidates make a big show of going to church. Mitt Romney, by all accounts, really went out of his way on the campaign trail to practice his faith. On Sundays, regardless of where he was in the country, he tried to find a Mormon sacrament meeting to go to. He would read the Bible and Book of Mormon on his iPad. But yeah, for most of the campaign, I think until the convention, they really tried to downplay it.
And you could argue that that backfired, because all these jokes about Romney being robotic or soulless mm-hmm. may have arisen at least in part out of the fact that his spiritual life was kept so private.
Right. Now, do I think that if the campaign had been really open about his religion, would that have swung the election? I don't think so. But I do think that America really got an education on his religion despite the campaign's best efforts.
And you bookend your article with your own experience in the evolving thinking about Mormonism among your peers. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that?
I start the article with an early experience on the campaign in South Carolina. I was sitting on a campaign bus. It was late at night. And I heard some reporters just behind me talking about Mitt Romney's underwear. Devout Mormons who are adults wear a religious undergarment, which basically looks like white boxer briefs and a white T-shirt. For Mitt Romney, that had been kind of a taboo issue. And these reporters were sitting on the bus talking because one of the reporters had happened upon Romney and his wife doing laundry in the basement of the hotel. And one of them said, "Well, did you see his underwear when you were down there?" And they kind of all giggled. and I wasn't part of the conversation. And when they started talking about the underwear, I just kind of slid down in my seat. By the end of the year, one of the very last rallies I went to, I was sitting on a bus and another reporter came up to me and started asking me questions about the Mormon underwear. And no one was giggling. He was, you know, talking in full voice, being very casual and was just saying, "Oh, yeah, well, what does it look like? I think I saw some pictures on the internet and it didn't seem that weird to me." And I think that, you know, as funny as it is, these things in Mormonism have come to be accepted as just another quirk of another religion, like all religions have. As I write in the piece, Mitt Romney was never a great politician, but I think if he has one political legacy, it will be that he helped Mormonism enter kind of the mainstream of America. And I don't think the next time a Mormon runs for president, people will be asking about his underwear.
McKay, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
McKay Coppins covers politics for BuzzFeed.
Coming up, what if you launched a military campaign and invited everybody to follow it on Twitter?
Well, it looks like you'd be Israel. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Israel launched an air assault on Gaza this week in retaliation, it said, for months of rocket attacks from the territory into southern Israel. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, dubbed the offensive pillar of defense. The opening salvo of the operation was a missile attack that killed Hamas military chief Ahmad Jabari. But the IDF wasn't content merely to do its thing. In a move unprecedented in military or media history, the IDF announced its attack on Twitter and tracked the fighting all day long through a live blog, posting maps, posters, and even a video of the missile strike. To help put this in perspective, we've invited Noah Schachtman, editor of Wired Magazine's Danger Room blog, which covers the intersection of technology and national security. Noah, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
We know about social gaming. We know about social viewing. Social warring is a new one, huh?
Militaries have been using social media for several years now, but the aggressiveness in this social media campaign, I've never seen anything like it.
Tell me about how social media has popped up in previous conflict in the region and where Israel fit into all of that.
So Israel sort of got into this social media warfare by accident. In 2009, during Operation Cast Lead, which was the last major incursion into Gaza, Israel embedded camera crews with its infantry teams because it was worried that those infantry teams would be accused of war crimes, and it wanted evidence that this was not the case. And so a young group of American Israelis in the IDF public affairs unit decided to take those videos and upload them to YouTube, kind of without anybody else in the IDF noticing. Unexpectedly, they became YouTube smashes and racked up several million views apiece. And so the IDF then set up a new media unit. It didn't always exactly shape the narrative the way Israel liked. During 2010, when a series of ships bound for Gaza were attacked by Israel and several people died, the world didn't exactly embrace the IDF after that, but it was the seeds of what we see today.
Now, it's one thing to inoculate yourself against subsequent charges of war atrocities and so forth, and another to use social media so aggressively to the point of actually taunting the enemy, which actually went back and forth in this Twitter battle between the IDF and some of the more militant Gazans.
Yeah, that's right. So the IDF, after it took out this guy Jabari, tweeted that basically all members of Hamas better keep their heads down if they want to live. And the Al-Qassam Brigades, which is the militant wing of Hamas, basically said, we're going to go get you and we're going to open up the gates of hell for you, or something to that effect. What's behind all this? On the Israeli side, I think there's two things. Number one, there's an election season coming up. And as we know here in America, politicians tend to talk rather tough in the days leading up to an election. Number two is that there's a desire on the Israeli part to come away with kind of a clean win. In 2006, when they fought with Hezbollah, and in 2009, during Operation Cast Lead, there wasn't a sense that there was a singular victory, an equivalent of the Osama bin Laden raid. And so I think they're really being aggressive in touting this attack on Jabari, because he's really seen in Israel as one of the main villains in the Hamas rogues gallery.
Tell me about the Palestinian side. Are they keeping up with Israel?
The Al-Qassam Brigades, for a Islamic militant group, is pretty sophisticated, just like the IDF is. And they're accomplishing some of the similar tasks. Number one, they're highlighting their own casualties to sort of show to the world that the other side is monstrous. And they're also highlighting their own capabilities. Hamas has a new series of rockets that can reach the Tel Aviv region, which is something that Hamas has not been able to do previously.
And as we speak Thursday afternoon, apparently one of those rockets landed in the vicinity of central Tel Aviv. I want to ask you about the language in the Twitter battles. The Israelis are using perfect colloquial American English. The Palestinians are also tweeting in English, but in this extremely florid, over-the-top metaphor, like opening the gates of hell. Are they well served by their prose?
On the Gazan side, I think these are local social media guys. Whereas on the IDF side, their social media team started in America. It can seem at times like the Hamas media campaign is being run by Borat. And that may not be a good thing for them. On the other hand, I do think it lends a veneer of authenticity. And so that may balance out some of the slick, perfectly colloquial American English of the IDF's campaign.
The image of Jabari's sedan just disintegrating under the impact of the missile, it's pretty shocking. Is that transparency or is it scalp brandishing?
Honestly, probably a little bit of both. But I think no matter what you think of it, it's something we're going to see more of in the future. Twitter and YouTube ostensibly ban videos or tweets of violence and threats, but they haven't taken these down. And I think the reason is because if you start taking these down, you start to take down all sorts of images of war, some of which are incredibly useful to the world public to see. For example, the Syrian rebels have been incredibly aggressive about how they use YouTube and other forms of social media as they fight the Assad regime. And with so few reporters able to get into Syria, this is really one of the only ways we're able to see what's happening there. Look, I'm not sure this is going to happen everywhere. In remote corners of Africa, I don't see this kind of social media warfare making much of a difference. But in a place like Israel and Gaza, where the world has an intense interest, I think this is just another step in what has always been a media-saturated conflict.
All right, Noah. Many thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Noah Shachtman is contributing editor at Wired Magazine and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Whatever you may think of Twitter, it's a powerful platform. But I'm guessing some of you are thinking, really? I gotta pay attention to this too? Hey, I wouldn't presume to advise. Just know that On the Media offers a shortcut. We tweet stories all week on a range of media issues, and then every Sunday our producers select their favorites and post them in our Week in Tweets on our blog. This week, there's a story from the Tribune about Chicago's City Hall illicitly recording reporters. And there's a piece from Kotaku about Petraeus' appearance in the latest Call of Duty video game. You'll find those and a lot more in the latest Week in Tweets at onthemedia.org. Just click on blog at the top of the page.
Late last year, I spoke to Hunter Moore, then the proprietor of a website called Is Anyone Up? The website's formula, which garnered Moore a lot of vitriol, a lot of traffic, and therefore a lot of ad revenue, was to upload nude pictures of people without their consent and post their names and links to their online accounts at places like Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. This April, Moore took down his website amid very bad press and rumors of an FBI investigation. Since then, various copycat sites have come and gone. The latest is the creatively named Is Anybody Down, the brainchild of two entrepreneurs named Craig Britton and Chance Trahan. While Is Anybody Down uses the same content formula as Is Anyone Up, nude pictures tied to real names, often without the model's consent, First Amendment attorney Mark Randazza finds that Trahan and Britton have added a little twist.
They put up a companion site that was for David Blade III, attorney at law. And for $250, he would be able to convince that site to take down your pictures.
So you open up Is Anybody Down. You see a picture which one night you drunkenly sent to a boyfriend, now an ex-boyfriend. And then there is this ad for a law firm that will help you take down that picture.
Yes. There was just something about that ad that struck me as strange, especially in that they guaranteed success, which no lawyer will ever do. First, I did a search for David Blade across the country to see where this guy was licensed. I found one David Blade in Florida who had no idea what I was talking about. And this guy claimed to be licensed in New York. So New York has a public database of all of its attorneys, and there is no attorney by the name of David Blade there. David Blade does not exist. It is one of two people. It is either Chance Trahan, one of the co-owners of the site, or Craig Britton, who lives in Colorado. One of these two guys is actually David Blade.
Now, why do you believe that this supposed lawyer with the 70s porn star name of David Blade is, in fact, one of the owners of the Is Anybody Down site?
I emailed David Blade and Mr. Britton, and their websites are hosted at the same obscure web host in the same IP range. Their emails are coming from the same exact IP address, the same MAC address. So unless Mr. Britton and Mr. Blade were both standing in the same room taking turns at the exact same keyboard, they're the same person.
Does anybody down has figured a way to generate revenue to get money out of the very people whose pictures it's publishing without their consent? You say there's a word for that kind of synergy. What's that word?
If you are trying to take money from somebody for something you don't otherwise have a right to, that's extortion. Now, they've accused me of extortion, hilariously enough, because I gave them a chance before I went public with this and said that if you give everybody their money back and take down the pictures of people who are not voluntarily on that site, then I'll go away. They said that that was extortion.
What do you think is going on with these guys?
They thought they had a way to make some money, and they have absolutely no morals. The thought of taking somebody and involuntarily making them a porn star, involuntarily putting their pictures out there, that's bad enough. But when you add to it that they pay people to find out the photograph subject's identity, where they live, if you look on these postings, you're going to find a significant number of them have even their home phone numbers posted on it.
You are not what anybody would describe as a blue nose. Au contraire, you have built your career as something close to a First Amendment absolutist in defense of pornographers. But you have a couple of basic rules about who you will represent.
Look, I have two rules for pornography. It must be of adults and it must be of consenting subjects. Other than that, anything goes as far as I'm concerned in a free country. If it doesn't meet Mark Randazza's standard for what's moral, it must be bad.
So what's going to happen here, Mark?
You know, I put out an offer that I would represent victims of the site pro bono, and I've gotten a lot of responses.
So you're undercutting David Blade III by $250. Your price point is $0.
I'm a really lucky person. I get to do cases that I believe in. I make a good living at it. And I think I have a responsibility to give something back to people who couldn't otherwise afford me, who need my help. But what's really cool is I got an overwhelming number of emails from attorneys in states where I'm not licensed saying, I'm here with you if you have anybody that wants to bring suit in this state. I've talked to a number of the victims and said, look, you realize you pay this guy the $250, it goes away and that's it. You get into a lawsuit here, your neighbors and friends and family are going to know about this. I am not going to be able to protect your privacy. And each one of them has said, I don't care. What's right is right. I even told them there's probably no money in this because these guys don't have any money. They still didn't care. Every single one of the victims said, I need to stand up so that the next girl doesn't go through this. It's really reaffirmed my faith in humanity.
All right, Mark. It's been an adventure. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
Attorney Mark Randazza blogs at The Legal Satyricon. Craig Britton agreed to talk to us only on the condition that we make no mention of Mark Randazza in our interview, but there was plenty more to discuss. Britton has written online that his long-term goal is to become one of the wealthiest people in the world. So I thought I'd ask him this. Is public shaming of people in their most indiscreet moments, is that how you want to make your fortune?
It's part of a progressive cause. We believe that a lot of the laws governing nudity around the world, and especially here in the U.S., should be changed. We live in an era where people are judged for these pictures. My eventual goal is that everyone will have public information posted about them, preferably naked, that it'll be a normal thing. It'll no longer be associated with stigma or shame or humiliation, but it'll be normal in about 10 years.
I literally don't understand what you're trying to
tell
me.
Well, let me explain. Most of these people aren't really upset that they're being seen naked. They're really upset that their boss might see, or that a close friend or family member might see, and that they might be judged. My point is eventually that employers will have to change their policies. Friends and family members will have to change the way they look at people.
How many martyrs to the cause will you create along the way?
These are not victims. These are people that have decided to publicly transmit their own information.
Of course they're victims. The moment you put them up for public display, they, by definition, are victims because they did not sign on for that.
I don't believe that's true.
Does your mother know what you do for a living?
They know, and my parents don't really care. They understand that we're in one of the toughest economic periods in the history of this country right now. A lot of people's backs are against the wall.
This is not a decision that you can make lightly to go into this business. Did you wrestle with your conscience?
We've tried to run 1,000 different businesses. Here's a direct quote from one of our one of the people that's making all these comments about us and saying what we're doing is big and evil. He said, and I quote, journalism is a lazy, unethical profession. And we, at one point, both attempted to be journalists. We attempted to be internet programmers. We attempted to be anything under the sun that we could after applying for job after job and being turned down. And this was kind of a last resort.
I'm wondering if you possess a modicum of empathy for the people who get up in the morning and find that their pictures are displayed naked on the web and that if their lives aren't destroyed, they're seriously harmed.
I have also been posted. I've been posted to a bunch of different websites. They posted my home address. They posted my family members' names. They posted naked photos of me. So I do know exactly how those people feel, actually.
And?
And I don't send naked pictures of myself to strangers.
Why not?
Well, you know, you could wind up on websites like the one I have, or, you know, worse. There are worse people out there than us. We're being the focus of this, like we're evil, or like we're manipulative, or we're exploiting people, and that's not true. The truth is that there's a lot of actual predators out there that are dangerous.
Craig, I'm asking you this man to man.
Right.
Do something else. You can't rationalize it.
I can't rationalize starving either.
You know what? Starve. Starve.
No.
Stand on the median strip of the highway and beg. There's more dignity in that than in what you're doing now.
I tried that. I wasn't good at that either.
I just want to thank you for getting on the phone with us.
Well, thank you.
Craig Britton, with his partner Chance Trahan, is the proprietor of isanybodydown.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.